Lincoln, Disc 29.
With his cabinet reconstituted, Lincoln turned to asserting his leadership of the Republican Party in the Congress. By the end of June 1864, the first session of the 38th Congress was drawing to an end, a session marked more by rancorous squabbling than by constructive legislation. Congressional Republicans were now more sharply divided into radical and conservative factions, both of which were critical of the president. Congressmen found many grounds of complaint, and most shared a sense that the executive branch had aggrandized itself during the war at the expense of the legislative branch. On no issue was there more hostility to the president than on Reconstruction. Support of Lincoln's 10% plan dropped sharply after Banks permitted the reconstructed government of Louisiana to preserve that state's antebellum constitution, which failed to protect the rights of blacks. To show their disapproval, majorities in both houses of Congress refused to seat persons claiming to represent Louisiana and Arkansas. United in opposing the president's wishes, the Republican majority in Congress was slow to agree on alternative, positive actions. They failed to establish a much-needed Freedmen's Bureau, intended to oversee the transition of African Americans from slavery to freedom, and they couldn't muster a sufficient majority to adopt the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, which the president and the National Union Convention had strongly urged. In the final days of the session, when many members were absent, Republican leaders suddenly realized that they were about to adjourn without having passed any significant legislation concerning slavery, the freedmen, or Reconstruction. Hastily, they turned to a bill that Henry Winter Davis called the only practical measure of emancipation proposed in this Congress. Called the Wade-Davis Bill, after the chairman of the House and Senate committees that sponsored it, the measure asserted congressional rather than executive control over the Reconstruction process. It required, as a first step in the reorganization of any Southern state, the complete abolition of slavery. The bill specified that 50%, rather than 10% of the 1860 voters, must participate in elections to reconstitute these governments. Further, it imposed on electors of constitutional conventions in the seceded states what was called an ironclad oath of loyalty, requiring them to swear that they had never voluntarily borne arms against the United States or aided the rebellion, rather than the oath of prospective loyalty in Lincoln's plan of amnesty. Passed by Congress on July 2nd, the bill reflected Davis's personal hostility toward Lincoln for siding with the Blairs, the leaders of the rival Republican faction in Maryland. It also demonstrated the continuing opposition on the part of some radical Republicans to Lincoln's reelection, despite his renomination by the Baltimore Convention. Looking toward an alternative or third-party candidacy for the presidency, they feared that Lincoln might win re-election through the electoral votes of the states under military control, like Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee, which were, in effect, pocket boroughs. Faced with a revolt on the part of Republican congressional leadership, Lincoln decided to reassert his authority. Indeed, he had to do so if he hoped to keep together the tenuous coalition of war Democrats and Republicans on which his re-election campaign rested. Rumors spread that he was not going to sign the bill. 2 days before adjournment, Representatives Thaddeus Stevens, E.B. Washburn and John L. Dawson of Pennsylvania descended on the White House, officially to ask if the chief executive had any further messages to transmit to the Congress, but actually to urge Lincoln to approve the Wade-Davis bill. After greeting his visitors, Lincoln sat down at his desk, turned his back on them, and resumed his work, merely tilting his head a little as Stevens read the official message. Dawson thought the president looked as if he was ashamed of himself, out of place, and the representatives returned to Capitol Hill, suspecting that Lincoln would veto the Reconstruction bill. Hearing their news, Representative Jesse O. Norton, a radical from Illinois and an old friend of the president, rushed to the White House, and he too got the impression that Lincoln wouldn't sign. Lincoln was about to make a great mistake, Norton reported, but there was no use trying to prevent it. As Congress tried to complete its business by noon on July 4th, the president was in his room at the Capitol examining and signing numerous measures that had been passed during the final hours of the session. Intensely anxious about the fate of the Wade-Davis bill, Republican senators and representatives gathered about him and watched him push that measure aside. When Zachariah Chandler, the radical senator from Michigan, came in, he asked the president whether he was going to sign, and Lincoln replied with some impatience, "Mr. Chandler, this bill was placed before me a few minutes before Congress adjourns. It's a matter of too much importance to be swallowed in that way." Warned by Chandler that the veto will damage us fearfully in the Northwest, Lincoln defended his action on the ground that Congress had no authority to abolish slavery in the reconstructed states. When Chandler reminded him that this was no more than what he himself had done, the president testily replied, "I conceive that I may, in an emergency, do things on military grounds which cannot be done constitutionally by Congress." He further objected to the bill because he believed, incorrectly, that it implied that the rebellious states were no longer in the Union. "Now we can't survive that admission, I'm convinced," he told the little group around him, and he reminded them that the whole war was fought on the assumption that it wasn't possible for a state to secede. "If that be true, I'm not president. These gentlemen aren't Congress." As he left the Capitol, he was warned that offending the radicals might hurt his chances in the November election, and he responded with controlled anger, "If they choose to make a point upon this, I don't doubt that they can do harm. They've never been friendly to me, and I don't know that this'll make any special difference as to that. At all events, I must keep some consciousness of being somewhere near right. I must keep some standard of principle fixed within myself." After he'd cooled off a little, Lincoln decided to pocket veto the Wade-Davis bill, that is, to decline to sign it, so that with the adjournment of Congress, it would fail to become law. He took his case to the people by issuing a proclamation explaining his decision. He wasn't prepared to be inflexibly committed to any single plan of restoration, he wrote, nor was he prepared to declare that the free state constitutions and governments already adopted and installed in Arkansas and Louisiana shall be set aside and held for naught, thereby repelling and discouraging the loyal citizens who've set up the same as to further effort. He was unwilling to acknowledge a constitutional competency in Congress to abolish slavery in states. Then, attempting to paper over differences with the Congress, he declared that he was fully satisfied with the system for restoration contained in the bill, as one very proper plan for the loyal people of any state choosing to adopt it. And he offered assistance to any state that decided to do so. The assurance was virtually meaningless, however, since the terms imposed by Congress were so much harsher than those required under the presidential plan of Reconstruction. Radicals reacted angrily to the defeat of the Wade-Davis bill. The president seemed to be toying with them. First, he used a pocket veto, a rare procedure up to this time. Then he issued what was, in effect, a veto message, which wasn't required for a pocket veto. And finally, he suggested that some southern states might want to accept the conditions laid down in the bill he'd just killed. According to a newspaperman, Davis, pale with wrath, his bushy hair tousled, and wildly brandishing his arms, denounced the president in good set terms. "I'm inconsolable," Charles Sumner grieved. But other congressmen, who perhaps hadn't paid careful attention to the debates on the measure, began to wish that it had never gone to the president. Resentment continued to smolder against Lincoln, but he remained in control of the field, clearly in charge both of his cabinet and of the Reconstruction process. How long he would remain in charge depended on the outcome of military operations, and the prospects were gloomy. By July, it seemed that Grant's campaign, which followed Lincoln's grand strategy, was a failure. In the West, Banks' army was demoralized after the failed Red River expedition, and it was months before General Edward R. S. Canby, who superseded Banks, was able to take to the field in a drive against Mobile. In Georgia, Sherman pushed the Confederates under Joseph E. Johnston back toward Atlanta, but the Southerners repeatedly escaped the traps he set for them. Eventually, Sherman grew so exasperated that he ordered a direct attack on the entrenched Confederates at Kennesaw Mountain, where on June 27th he met a bloody defeat. In the East, Butler allowed his Army of the James to be hemmed in on a peninsula between the James and the Appomattox rivers. And there, as Grant remarked acidly, his army was as useless as if it had been in a bottle strongly corked. In the Shenandoah Valley, Franz Sigel suffered a serious defeat at Newmarket on May 15th and had to be removed from command. His successor, David Hunter, began a campaign of devastation in the valley, but when Lee sent in troops under Jubal A. Early, Hunter retreated into the Kanawha Valley, leaving the Shenandoah an open corridor for the Confederates. Most serious of all were the reverses of the Army of the Potomac, over which Grant personally presided. Failing to overwhelm Lee's army either in the Wilderness or at Spotsylvania, Grant ordered the senseless and doomed charge at Cold Harbor. After this defeat, he no longer talked about fighting it out on this line, because he'd learned a lesson. Without a greater sacrifice of human life than I am willing to make, all cannot be accomplished that I'd designed. In a shift of strategy, on June 14th, he began moving the Army of the Potomac through the swamps of the Chickahominy River, where McClellan's troops had fought in 1862, to the south side of the James River. There, the Army of the Potomac, joining with Butler's army, could be supplied by sea. And there, in a return to Grant's original strategic plan, it could cut the rail lines that connected Richmond to the south. Grant's change of base was brilliantly executed, so that Lee had no certain idea of his whereabouts. Once his army had crossed the James, Grant launched an immediate assault on the heavily fortified city of Petersburg, through which three of the key railroads ran. Repulsed, he settled down for a siege. Now, for the first time, he contemplated a campaign of attrition. He would pin Lee's army down so that no reinforcements could be sent to fight against Sherman. In 6 weeks of incessant fighting, the Union armies lost in killed and wounded nearly 100,000 men, more than the total number in Lee's army at the beginning of the campaign. The people of the North, who'd been overly optimistic when Grant assumed command of the armies, were slow to realize what was happening. Their newspapers, controlled by War Department censorship, told them that Grant had won a great victory, that the Army of the Potomac again is victorious, that the troops had been skillfully and bravely handled, and that Grant had succeeded, if not in defeating Lee, certainly in turning his strong position and forcing him to retreat step by step to the very confines of Richmond. But then the daily black-bordered newspaper columns listing the dead brought home the enormity of war. So did the stories from newspaper correspondents and the letters from soldiers describing the suffering of the maimed and wounded. As thousands of injured poured into the hospitals around Washington, it was no longer possible to conceal the costs of the campaign. The country shuddered with a sickening revulsion at the slaughter. Grieving for our bleeding, bankrupt, almost dying country, Horace Greeley wrote the president of the widespread dread of the prospect of fresh conscriptions, of further wholesale devastations, and of new rivers of human blood. Lincoln himself was sensitive to the suffering. His friend Isaac N. Arnold recorded that during these days he was grave and anxious, and he looked like one who had lost the dearest member of his own family. One evening, after riding past a long line of ambulances carrying the wounded to the hospital, he turned to Arnold in deep sadness and said, "Look yonder at those poor fellows. I can't bear it. This suffering, this loss of life, is dreadful." The Lincolns did what they could to mitigate the hardships. Mary Lincoln regularly visited army hospitals, bringing the wounded flowers from the White House conservatory and comforting words. For his part, the president set aside a morning of nearly every week to review the court-martial sentences of soldiers who'd found the stress of battle more than they could bear. One week, he examined the records in 67 cases, in another, 72 cases, in yet another, 36 cases. Whenever possible, he found excuses to release the prisoners and allowed them to return to duty. He was, he explained, trying to evade the butchering business lately. But all his exertions couldn't erase the knowledge that in the final analysis, he was responsible for all this suffering. Increasingly, he brooded over the war and his role in it. "Doesn't it seem strange to you that I should be here?" he once asked Representative Daniel Voorhees of Indiana. "Doesn't it strike you as queer that I, who couldn't cut the head off of a chicken, and who was sick at the sight of blood, should be cast into the middle of a great war with blood flowing all about me?" Often, when he could spare the time from his duties, he sought an answer to his questions in the well-thumbed pages of his Bible, reading most often the Old Testament prophets and the Psalms. He found comfort and reassurance in the Bible. He was not a member of any Christian church, for he was put off by their forms and dogmas, and consequently he remained, as Mary Lincoln later said, not a technical Christian. But he drew from the Scriptures such solace that he was prepared to forget his earlier religious doubts. One evening, during this dreadful summer of 1864, his old friend Joshua Speed found him intently reading the Bible. "I'm glad to see you so profitably engaged," said Speed. "Yes," replied the president, "I'm profitably engaged." "Well," commented the visitor, "if you've recovered from your skepticism, I'm sorry to say that I have not." Looking his old comrade in the face, Lincoln said, "You're wrong, Speed. Take all of this book upon reason that you can, and the balance on faith, and you'll live and die a happier and better man." He'd come to feel, as he told a delegation of Baltimore African Americans who presented him a magnificently bound Bible in appreciation of his work for the Negro, that this great book is the best gift God has given to man. Reading the Bible reinforced Lincoln's long-held belief in the doctrine of necessity, a belief that admirably fitted the needs of his essentially passive personality. The idea that the actions of any individual were predetermined and shaped by the unknowable wishes of some higher power wasn't a new one for him, but with the burden of a never-ending war weighing ever more heavily on his shoulders, he reverted to it more and more frequently. In April, he wrote a long letter to Albert G. Hodges, editor of the Frankfort, Kentucky Commonwealth, explaining why he'd felt compelled to shift from his inaugural pledge not to interfere with slavery to the policy of emancipation. It contained his most explicit view of individual responsibility. "I claim not to have controlled events, but confess plainly that events have controlled me. Now," he continued, "at the end of 3 years' struggle, the nation's condition isn't what either party or any man devised or expected. God alone can claim it." Again and again he reverted to the idea that behind all the struggles and losses of the war, a divine purpose was at work. Never did he express this view more eloquently than in a letter he wrote in September to Mrs. Eliza P. Gurney, who extended the sympathy and prayers of the Society of Friends. "The purposes of the Almighty are perfect and must prevail, though we erring mortals may fail to accurately perceive them in advance. We hoped for a happy termination of this terrible war long before this, but God knows best and has ruled otherwise. We must work earnestly in the best light he gives us, trusting that so working still conduces to the great ends he ordains. Surely he intends some great good to follow this mighty convulsion, which no mortal could make and no mortal could stay." This comforting doctrine allowed the president to live with himself by shifting some of the responsibility for all the suffering. As Grant and Sherman grappled with the enemy, Lincoln did what he could to sustain the army and to boost civilian morale. On every possible occasion, even on such an unlikely one as the resumption of White House concerts by the Marine Band, he asked his listeners to give 3 cheers for Grant and all the armies under his command. Again and again, he expressed gratitude to the soldiers, to the officers, and especially to that brave and loyal man, the modest general at the head of our armies. After his renomination, when the Ohio delegation serenaded him with a brass band, He responded, "What we want, still more than Baltimore conventions or presidential elections, is success under General Grant." And he urged his hearers to bend all their energies to support the brave officers and soldiers in the field. He continued to have great faith in Grant, but he was conscious of the swelling chorus of criticism of the general. Many doubted Grant's strategic ability and pointed out that in shifting his base to the James River, he was simply repeating what McClellan had done, with far fewer casualties. Why didn't he take his army south of the James at once and thus save 75,000 men? Asked Senator Grimes, who pronounced Grant's campaign a failure. Even in the president's own household, there was distrust of the general. "He's a butcher," Mary Lincoln often said, "and isn't fit to be at the head of an army." The outcry against Grant made the president want to see for himself what was happening with the Army of the Potomac. And on June 20th, accompanied by Tad, he made an unheralded visit to Grant's headquarters at City Point. Looking, as Horace Porter, one of Grant's aides, wrote, very much like a boss undertaker, in his black suit, the president announced as he landed, "I just thought I'd jump aboard a boat and come down and see you. I don't expect I can do any good, and in fact I'm afraid I may do harm. But I'll put myself under your orders, and if you find me doing anything wrong, just send me off right away." For the next 2 days, he visited with Grant, Meade, Butler, and the troops. Much of the time, he rode Grant's large bay horse, Cincinnati. Though he managed the horse well, he was, as Porter remembered, not a very dashing rider. And as his trousers gradually worked up above his ankles, he gave the appearance of a country farmer riding into town wearing his Sunday clothes. As news of the president's arrival reached the troops, they gave cheers and enthusiastic shouts. When he rode out to see the African-American troops of the 18th Corps, the soldiers cheered, laughed, cried, sang hymns of praise, and shouted, "God bless Master Lincoln! The Lord save Father Abraham! The day of Jubilee is come sure!" Telling frequent anecdotes and showing interest in every detail of Army life, the president appeared to have no object in his visit. But his purpose emerged when there was talk of anticipated military maneuvers. Quietly, he interposed, "I can't pretend to advise, but I do sincerely hope that all may be accomplished with as little bloodshed as possible." Tired and sunburned, Lincoln returned to the White House on June 23rd, and Gideon Welles remarked that the trip had done him good physically and strengthened him mentally. He took satisfaction in repeating what Grant had told him. "You'll never hear of me farther from Richmond than now, till I've taken it. It may take a long summer day, but I'll go in." But Attorney General Bates found the president perceptibly disappointed at the small measure of our success in that region. More than ever, Lincoln realized that the war would be long and costly. Chapter 19. I'm Pretty Sure-Footed. In early July 1864, a visitor found Lincoln deeply depressed, indeed quite paralyzed and wilted down. He had reason to feel blue. War weariness was spreading, and demands for negotiations to end the killing were becoming strident. In the Middle West, the Copperhead movement was strong, and there were rumors of an insurrection intended to bring about an independent Northwest Confederation. The Democrats were organizing for their national convention to be held in Chicago at the end of August, and they were likely to adopt a peace platform. The Republicans were badly divided, and Lincoln was whipsawed between those who thought he was too lenient toward the South and those who thought him too severe. Worst of all, the Union armies appeared stalemated. Sherman, at the head of the Western armies, was approaching Atlanta, but was not, apparently, nearer victory over Joseph E. Johnston. In the East, the Army of the Potomac was bogged down in a siege of Petersburg. To make matters worse, Washington itself was once more threatened. In an attempt to relieve Grant's pressure on Richmond, Jubal A. Early, heading the Second Corps of the Army of Northern Virginia, marched down the Shenandoah Valley almost without opposition, and on July 5th crossed the Potomac. His force was small, only about 15,000 men. But as it spread out over the Maryland countryside, it was strong enough to levy tribute from Hagerstown and Frederick before turning east toward Washington. On July 9th, at the Monocacy River, the invaders pushed aside the ill-assorted Union defending force of Green 100-Day Volunteers, commanded by General Lew Wallace, and moved close to the national capital. It seemed that nobody was in charge of the defenses of Washington, or perhaps everybody was. Off in Virginia, Grant doubted that the Confederates were making any significant northward movement and was reluctant to divert troops from the siege of Petersburg. Stanton questioned the seriousness of Early's raid. Halleck did what he could by giving rifles to the clerks in the government offices and arming the ambulatory soldiers in the hospitals. But it was far from clear that this makeshift force could hold off the Confederate invaders. Alarmed, General Ethan Allen Hitchcock tried to alert the president that the Capitol was in great danger. But Lincoln wearily replied, "We're doing all we can." Early's army might not be strong enough to hold Washington, Hitchcock warned, but if they occupied it for only a few days, the nation would be dishonored, and the Confederacy would be recognized abroad. He insisted that Grant ought to be directed to send reinforcements. Seeming almost crushed, and speaking very faintly, Lincoln responded that he'd confer with the Secretary of War. Unlike many in the Capitol, the president wasn't worried about his own safety. He only reluctantly obeyed Stanton's directive to move back into the city from the exposed soldiers' home, where he, Mary, and Tad were spending the summer. And he was furious when he learned that Gustavus V. Fox had ordered a naval vessel to be ready in the Potomac in case the Lincolns needed to escape. As during previous invasions of the North, he was less concerned about the security of Washington than with the capture of the Confederate force, but he was hamstrung by his pledge not to interfere with Grant's operations. Knowing how severely he'd been criticized for meddling with military matters, especially in the case of McClellan, he was reluctant now to give direct orders to his general-in-chief. All he felt he could do was to keep a close watch over Early's progress and try to prevent panic in Washington and Baltimore. But when Grant grandly announced that there were already enough forces in the area to defeat the invaders and offered to come to the Capitol himself only if the president thought it necessary, Lincoln responded on July 10th that he should leave enough men to retain his hold on Petersburg and bring the rest of your army with you personally and make a vigorous effort to destroy the enemy's force in this vicinity. But the president ended his telegram, "This is what I think upon your suggestion, and is not an order. Still not understanding the seriousness of the threat, Grant chose to remain where he was, dispatching some veteran troops of the Sixth Corps under General Horatio G. Wright to assist in the defense of Washington. On July 11th, before they could arrive, Early's men had already pushed down the 7th Street Pike, marched through Silver Spring, where Francis Preston Blair Sr. and Postmaster General Montgomery Blair both had houses, and approached the sturdy but feebly manned defenses of Fort Stevens. The Confederates drove in the Union pickets and came within 150 yards of the fort before artillery fire forced them back. Lincoln was in the fort when it was first attacked. Having driven out from Washington in his carriage, he mounted to the front parapet. He borrowed a field glass from Signal Officer Asa Townsend Abbott and looked out over the field where the Confederates were advancing. He stood there with a long frock coat and plug hat on, making a very conspicuous figure, Abbott recalled. When the Confederates came within shooting distance, an officer twice cautioned Lincoln to get down, but he paid no attention. Then a man standing near him was shot in the leg, and a soldier roughly ordered the president to get down, or he'd have his head knocked off. He coolly descended, got into his carriage, and was driven back to the city, where he went to the wharf to greet troops of the Sixth Corps, chatting familiarly with the veterans, and now and then, as if in compliment to them, biting at a piece of hardtack which he held in his hand. The next day, Early made one last effort to capture the capital. Once again, the heaviest fighting was at Fort Stevens, and President and Mrs. Lincoln, along with many other prominent public officials and their wives, came out to witness the fighting. Thoughtlessly, Wright invited the president to mount the parapet in order to get a clear view as Union soldiers charged the enemy line. And the general recorded that Lincoln evinced remarkable coolness and disregard of danger. After a surgeon standing near him was shot, Wright ordered the parapet cleared and asked the president to step down. Lincoln insisted on remaining until the general said he'd have him removed forcibly. The absurdity of the idea of sending off the president under guard seemed to amuse him, Wright recalled. But in consideration of my earnestness in the matter, he agreed to compromise by sitting behind the parapet instead of standing upon it. After the failure of his final assault, Early retreated from Washington. Wright made a half-hearted attempt to follow the Confederates, but he soon halted, as Lincoln said scornfully, for fear he might come across the rebels and catch some of them. Browning found the president in the dumps, lamenting that the rebels who'd besieged us were all escaped. Though half a dozen generals, Wright, Hunter, Sigel, Wallace, and others, were involved, nobody was in charge of pursuing the enemy. As Assistant Secretary of War Charles A. Dana wrote Grant, "There's no head to the whole, and it seems indispensable that you should at once appoint one. General Halleck won't give orders except as he receives them. The president will give none, and until you direct positively and explicitly what's to be done, everything will go on in the deplorable and fatal way in which it's gone on for the past week." Lincoln's patience, even with Grant, began to wear thin. Early continued to stage raids from the Shenandoah, and on July 30th, his men rode into Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, demanded a ransom of $500,000 in currency or $100,000 in gold, and when the townsmen were unable to pay it, burned the town. Northern newspapers decried the humiliation of the raids, which showed there's folly or incompetence somewhere in our military administration. But Grant, still entrenched before Petersburg, seemed little concerned. Not even a personal visit from the president, who summoned him to Fort Monroe on July 31st, stirred the general from the lethargy into which he'd unaccountably lapsed. On hearing of Early's continuing activities, he telegraphed that all the Union forces in the Shenandoah Valley Command should put themselves south of the enemy and follow him to the death. Lincoln replied that his strategy was just right, but he added tartly, "Please look over the dispatches you may have received from here and discover, if you can, that there is any idea in the head of anyone here of putting our army south of the enemy, or of following him to the death in any direction." "I repeat to you," the president insisted, "it will neither be done nor attempted unless you watch it every day and hour and force it." Called to heel, Grant immediately started for Washington, and after consultation with the president, named the brilliant young cavalry officer, Philip Sheridan, to command all the Union forces operating in the valley. It wasn't only Grant who tried Lincoln's patience during these unusually hot, depressing summer months of 1864. Usually, he was ready to spend countless hours listening to visitors who brought him their complaints and petitions, sometimes over quite trivial matters. But now he'd had enough. When two citizens of Maine asked him to intervene to settle a personal problem, the president sharply responded, "You want me to end your suspense? I'll do so. Don't let me hear another word about your case." A few days later, his anger erupted again when Charles Gibson resigned as solicitor in the Court of Claims, protesting the radicalism of the Republican platform, but expressing gratitude to the president for treating him with personal kindness and consideration. With what Bates called blind impetuosity, Lincoln lashed back that there were two small drawbacks upon Mr. Gibson's right to still receive such treatment, one of which is that he never could learn of his giving much attention to the duties of his office, and the other is this studied attempt of Mr. Gibson's to stab him. In calmer times, Lincoln would have ignored a semi-literate communication from a Pennsylvania man who urged him to remember that white men is in class number one and black men is in class number two and must be governed by white men forever. But now, in his irascible mood, he drafted a reply to be sent out over Nicolay's signature, requesting the writer to inform him whether you are either a white man or a black one, because in either case you cannot be regarded as an entirely impartial judge. It may be, the president continued, in an unusual tone of sarcasm, that you belong to a third or fourth class of yellow or red men, in which case the impartiality of your judgment would be more apparent. Lincoln's sharp temper extended at times even to his closest advisers. Montgomery Blair, furious because Early's men had burned his house in Silver Spring, denounced the poltroons and cowards responsible for the defenses of Washington. Halleck, always defensive of professional military men, demanded that the president either endorse such wholesale denouncement and accusation, or dismiss Blair. Lincoln replied that he didn't approve the Postmaster General's remarks, but that his words, which may have been hastily said in a moment of vexation at so severe a loss, weren't sufficient grounds for removing him. I propose continuing to be myself the judge as to when a member of the cabinet shall be dismissed, he said sternly. And he took the unusual step of reading to the entire cabinet a carefully prepared memorandum. I must myself be the judge, how long to retain in and when to remove any of you from his position. It had greatly pained me to discover any of you endeavoring to procure another's removal or in any way to prejudice him before the public. Such endeavor would be a wrong to me, and much worse, a wrong to the country. On the more important issue of possible peace negotiations with the Confederates, the President was obliged to control his anger. Indeed, he gained a certain sardonic pleasure from his skillful handling of the question. The prime mover was the erratic and excitable editor of the New York Tribune. Just as Early's men were approaching the Capitol, Greeley wrote Lincoln that his irrepressible friend, William C. Colorado Jewett, was certain that representatives of the Confederate government were on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls with full authority to negotiate a peace. Greeley urged the President to explore the possibility, because the country was in such desperate shape. A full and generous announcement of Union conditions for ending the war, even if they were not accepted, would remove the widespread conviction that the government and its prominent supporters aren't anxious for peace and help the Republican cause in the fall elections. Correctly, Lincoln suspected a trap. He couldn't know why the three Confederate emissaries, former Mississippi Congressman Jacob Thompson, former Alabama Senator Clement C. Clay, and Professor James P. Holcomb of the University of Virginia, were in Canada, but his instincts told him that their purpose was not to make peace, but to meddle in northern politics with a view to influencing the presidential election. He couldn't reject the proposed negotiations outright, even though he thought Greeley unreliable and mendacious, but this chosen intermediary of the Confederates had the power to shape northern opinion. The New York Tribune, widely distributed in the West as well as in the East, boasted the largest national circulation of any newspaper. The editor's letter, which reminded the President how intently the people desire any peace consistent with the national integrity and honor, and that an offer of fair terms would prove an immense and sorely needed advantage to the national cause, thinly masked a threat to go public in case Lincoln turned down this opportunity. If the Tribune portrayed the President as flatly rejecting a reasonable peace negotiation, it could do irreparable damage. Shrewdly, Lincoln solved his problem by naming Greeley himself as his emissary to the Confederates at Niagara, and authorizing him to bring to Washington under safe conduct any person anywhere professing to have any proposition of Jefferson Davis in writing for peace, embracing the restoration of the Union and the abandonment of slavery. Greeley objected. For all his countrified looks and his shuffling gait, the editor was no fool, and he was unwilling to become a confidant, far less an agent in such negotiations. But the President refused to let him off the hook. "I not only intend a sincere effort for peace," he wrote Greeley, "but I intend that you shall be a personal witness that it's made." When Greeley continued to delay, the President expressed disappointment. "I was not expecting you to send me a letter, but to bring me a man, or men. He then ordered John Hay to accompany Greeley to Niagara Falls, bearing a letter that spelled out the terms on which he was willing to deal with the Confederate emissaries. Lincoln himself drafted the letter, consulting only Seward. Addressed to whom it may concern, it read, "Any proposition which embraces the restoration of peace, the integrity of the whole Union, and the abandonment of slavery will be received and considered by the executive government of the United States." It also offered safe conduct to the Confederate negotiators and liberal terms on other substantial and collateral points. The letter reflected Lincoln's careful balancing of political considerations against military needs. He could best promote his chances in the fall election by requiring only minimal conditions for beginning negotiations with the Confederates. If he announced that reunification of the nation was the sole condition for peace, he'd cement the alliance that he'd been trying for months to build with the war Democrats, who loyally supported his efforts to restore the Union, even though many of them had reservations about his emancipation policy. If, as he anticipated, Jefferson Davis rejected this reasonable, lenient offer, these Democrats could more easily favor the reelection of a Republican president. But there was an unacceptable military risk in this approach. Conceivably, the Confederates might accept reunion as a condition for discussing peace. If they did, they could propose a ceasefire during the progress of any negotiations. And Lincoln knew that the people were so war-weary and exhausted that it would be almost impossible to resume hostilities once arms were laid down. An armistice, a cessation of hostilities, is the end of the struggle, he concluded, and the insurgents would be in peaceable possession of all that's been struggled for. Consequently, he had to appear open to peace negotiations while proposing terms that would make them impossible. The first of his conditions, the restoration of the Union, was easy to predict. That was what the war, from the outset, had been about. But the second, requiring the abandonment of slavery as a condition for peace talks, was a surprise. It went considerably beyond his own Emancipation Proclamation or any law of Congress. The Emancipation Proclamation had freed slaves only in specified areas and had not ended the institution of slavery itself, and Congress had just failed to adopt the 13th Amendment outlawing slavery. This condition was one Lincoln knew the Confederates would never accept. Lincoln expected that the Confederate emissaries would spurn his offer. When they rushed to print his "To Whom It May Concern" letter, in order to show that he'd torpedoed meaningful peace talks, he countered by publicizing the report he'd just received from James R. Gilmore and James F. Jacquess, who'd recently conducted their own unofficial peace mission to Richmond. There, Jefferson Davis told them, "The war must go on till the last man of this generation falls in his tracks, unless you acknowledge our right to self-government. We're not fighting for slavery. We're fighting for independence. And that, or extermination, we will have." Reasonable people could only conclude that neither president wanted serious peace negotiations. The New York Herald announced that publication of the president's "To Whom It May Concern" letter sealed Lincoln's fate in the upcoming presidential campaign. By making abolition as much a war aim as Union, The president gave new strength to the Democratic Party, preparing for its national convention in Chicago at the end of August. Opposition leaders declared the letter proved Lincoln didn't really want to end the war, even if an honorable peace were within his grasp. All he has a right to require of the South is submission to the Constitution, Democratic editors announced. They were sure that the people of the loyal states will teach him. They'll not supply men and treasure to prosecute a war in the interest of the black race. The president's letter also undermined his support in his own party. At first, oddly enough, the erosion was most noticeable among the radicals. Greeley's animus toward the president increased after his venture into amateur diplomacy became a subject of ridicule. He wasn't alone. Radicals, who should have been pleased by the president's firm insistence on abolition, felt they had Lincoln on the run, and they began to express all their pent-up grievances and frustrations at the president's slowness, his timidity, his indecisiveness, his fence-straddling, his incompetence, his leniency toward the rebels. Chase, though ostensibly out of politics, spent much of the summer in New England conferring with other anti-Lincoln Republicans and spreading the news that there was great and almost universal dissatisfaction with Mr. Lincoln among all earnest men. In Boston, he frequently conferred with Sumner, who grumbled that the country needed a president with brains, one who can make a plan and carry it out. Pomeroy, the original head of the Chase movement, and Wade, co-author of the Reconstruction Bill Lincoln had just vetoed, joined them for a conference, which, as a newspaper correspondent shrewdly surmised, boded no good to Father Abraham. Radical disaffection wasn't confined to New England. In Iowa, Grimes concluded, "This entire administration's been a disgrace from the very beginning to everyone who had anything to do with bringing it into power. I take my full share of the shame to myself. I can atone for what I've done no otherwise than in refusing to be instrumental in continuing it." On August 5th, this dissatisfaction with Lincoln exploded with publication of a protest by Wade and Henry Winter Davis against Lincoln's grave executive usurpation in pocket vetoing their Reconstruction Bill. The congressman found the president's public message explaining the reasons for his action even more offensive than the veto. "A more studied outrage on the legislative authority of the people has never been perpetrated," they fumed. It was a blow at the friends of his administration, at the rights of humanity, and at the principles of Republican government. Lincoln must know that the authority of Congress is paramount and must be respected. And if he wishes our support, he must confine himself to his executive duties, to obey and execute, not make the laws. Publication of the Wade-Davis Manifesto, as it was generally called, produced a short-lived political commotion. Democrats, of course, enjoyed the spectacle of prominent congressional leaders attacking the presidential nominee of their own party. And they congratulated the country that two Republicans have been found willing at last to resent the encroachments of the executive on the authority of Congress. The manifesto, according to the New York World, was a blow between the eyes which will daze the president. The New York Herald, always glad to jab at the administration, called it an acknowledgment that Lincoln was an egregious failure, who ought to retire from the position to which, in an evil hour, he was exalted, But the rhetoric of the proclamation was so excessive, and the accusations against Lincoln so extreme, that the charges backfired. Most Republican papers criticized Wade and Davis more severely than they did the president. Lincoln didn't read the manifesto. He had no desire to get involved in a controversy with its authors, he told Wells. The attack saddened him, and he admitted to Noah Brooks, "To be wounded in the house of one's friends is perhaps the most grievous affliction that can befall a man." But he refused to brood about it. "It's not worth fretting about," he joked. "It reminds me of an old acquaintance who, having a son of a scientific turn, bought him a microscope. The boy went around experimenting with his glass upon everything. One day at the dinner table, his father took up a piece of cheese. 'Don't eat that, father,' said the boy. 'It's full of wrigglers.' 'My son,' replied the old gentleman, taking a huge bite, 'let 'em wriggle. I can stand it if they can.'" Less public, but more dangerous to the president, was a radical plan to replace Lincoln, already the official nominee of his party, with another candidate who would be more positive and energetic, who'd be more deeply committed to equal rights, and who would, presumably, have a greater chance of success. Little groups of radicals in Boston, Cincinnati, and especially New York, concocted plans for summoning a new Republican nominating convention. Some of the schemers favored Chase, others Butler. Few looked to Fremont, whose candidacy was already failing, and they tried to get him to withdraw from the race on the condition that Lincoln did so. Most put their hopes on Grant. In a preliminary meeting on August 18th, about 25 radicals gathered at the house of Mayor George Updike of New York. The editors of the major newspapers, Greeley of the Tribune, Park Godwin of the Evening Post, Theodore Tilton of the Independent, and George Wilkes of the Spirit of the Times, were present, as were Wade, Davis, and Governor John A. Andrew of Massachusetts. Chase sent his regrets, hoping that the deliberations would be fruitful, of benefit to our country, never more in need of wise words and fearless action by and among patriotic men. Sumner, too, stayed away. "I do not as yet see the presidential horizon," he explained. "I wait for the blue lights of the Democratic Convention at Chicago, which will present the true outlines." Those who did attend, the diarist George Templeton Strong termed them our wire pullers and secret unofficial governors, decided to send out a circular letter calling for a new convention to be held at Cincinnati on September 28th, which would concentrate the Union strength on some one candidate who commands the confidence of the country, even by a new nomination if necessary. Less politely, Davis said that the convention was intended to get rid of Mr. Lincoln and name new candidates. To make final arrangements, they promised to meet again on August 30th. Inevitably, reports of these plans reached Lincoln's ears. He was neither surprised nor worried by most of the schemes to replace him as the nominee of the Republican Party, but he was alarmed when he heard that the dissidents were thinking of running Grant. He didn't think the general had political aspirations, but concluding that he ought to sound him out again, he asked Colonel John Eaton, who'd worked closely with Grant in caring for the freedmen in the Mississippi Valley, to go to the Army of the Potomac and ascertain his views. At City Point, Eaton told Grant that many people thought he ought to run for president, not as a party man, but as a citizen's candidate, in order to save the Union. Bringing his hand down on the arm of his chair, Grant replied, "They can't do it. They can't compel me to do it." He went on to say that he considered it as important for the cause that Lincoln should be elected as that the army should be successful in the field. When Eaton reported the conversation to the president, his relief was obvious. "I told you," he said, "they couldn't get him to run until he'd closed out the rebellion."
This ends Disc 29.